Welcome to Unpacking Impact, a podcast that explores how rapid digital transformation shapes economics, culture, jobs, policy, and of course, you. Each episode, we speak with thought leaders that are playing and changing the game at the highest levels. Today, we bring you Peter Thiel. Peter is a Silicon Valley icon. He co-founded PayPal, made the first outside investment in Facebook, and is co-founder and chairman of Palantir Technologies. We dive deep into the impact of COVID-19, the U.S. rivalry with China, and the impact of artificial intelligence on the global economy. I'm Naveen Tukaram.
I'm Andrew Schwartz.
Let's begin. Well, Peter, you know, first off, welcome to the Unpacking Impact podcast. You know, we're so excited and fired up to have you as our first guest. As you probably know, the goal of the podcast is to try to explain the impact of rapid digital transformation on our society, on culture, on jobs, and ultimately policy. So we thought it just made sense to jump right into the big trend right now, which is COVID-19. And, you know, we've seen people everywhere struggle with the impact of COVID-19 around the world. Our first question is, what is this new normal that we should expect going forward? Or will perhaps a vaccine lead us back to where things were before 2020?
I keep thinking that there's always this discussion of how much everything's going to go back to normal next year, and that this is almost like a psychological tell that we're engaged in a form of wishful thinking, or that we deep down know that things are not going to go back to normal. And that what COVID-19, you know, it's obviously a stress and a crisis for the system, but it also revealed that there were many ways in which the system wasn't quite working. And I think the status quo ante simply doesn't make sense. People do not want to go back to 2019. So 2019 was a year of, you know, there were all these sort of old economy institutions that had been on autopilot for 20 years. You know, you think of 2020 as the first year of the 21st century, and the 20th century has gone on 20 years longer than it should have. Student debt was a problem in 2000. It was $300 billion. By 2019, it was $1.7 trillion. It was growing exponentially. It made no sense. 2020 is the year we jumped the shark, and you're spending $50,000 a year for Zoom calls instead of going to college. And everybody can see this is totally ridiculous. And I don't know if you go back to the pretty dysfunctional status quo ante. And I think what's true of the dysfunctional zombie colleges system is true of maybe all sorts of institutions. You know, since the mid-1990s, people had talked about telecommuting as sort of, you know, the next big innovation in transportation. You know, maybe what railroads were for the 19th century and highways were for the 20th, telecommuting could be for the 21st. And for whatever reason, you know, it didn't quite work. And maybe the technology wasn't quite there. Maybe it was just some sort of collective action problem where we didn't have the will to do it. But in 2020, we've gone into the 21st century. Perhaps we should have done it 20 years ago, but we've done it. And I think the super dysfunctional megacities like New York and San Francisco are not simply going to come back. You know, they're going to have to actually solve their problems, and they can't just count on 20th century network effects to bail them out, because in the 21st century, the network effects will not be driven as much by physical geography, but can be more virtual. And there's a sort of radical reconfiguration of what that a city is will mean in the years ahead. And so I think there are quite a number of things that will, you know, will live music concerts come back? I think so. I think people would like to go back to those. But I think there are a lot of 20th century institutions that I would be very, very skeptical of here. And it's going to be a very radical transformation in the years ahead of these, if these changes last.
Well, Peter, my friend Peter Shapiro, the rock music impresario, is going to be really happy to hear you say that people want to come back and see live music.
More than they want to live in a shoebox apartment in Manhattan, or than they want to spend $50,000 on a, you know, worthless college education.
Yeah. I mean, right now, all the people who own rock clubs and people who are concert promoters are streaming. And that's the only way you can see live music right now is streaming. I want to ask you along the lines of what you were just talking about. So you truly believe that things like work from home are here to stay? Do I assume that's right?
I think directionally it is going to stay that way. You know, the tech companies in Silicon Valley have been perhaps the most vigorous in pushing this. And, you know, if you have an internet company, one of the things you believe is that you're capable of using the internet yourself. And so it is very on brand for Silicon Valley to get remote work to work. And if you had a tech company that says we can't use the internet and remote work doesn't actually work for us, that actually at this point sounds like the wrong thing. So I think the, you know, they may not completely shift, but I think, you know, I think the big tech companies are going to make a pretty big shift. It will be pretty long lasting. You know, their employees have signed 1-year leases, you know, all over the country to live elsewhere. And I think it will just get rolled over from here. And then we can debate how much of the rest of the economy this will be true of. But if you sort of think of Silicon Valley tech as being, you know, where the future is going, that's probably going to last.
Yeah, Silicon Valley has definitely been one of the big beneficiaries of COVID-19. I mean, especially companies like Zoom and Microsoft, productivity companies, cloud communications. I'm curious, what other areas do you think are going to benefit from the long-term trend of COVID-19 and what areas are going to be hurt? Obviously, we know travel, hospitality has gotten hurt in the short term, but more over the medium term, maybe the next 2 to 3 years.
Certainly this year, I keep thinking it's like the same movie like in 99, 2000, where it's the new economy versus the old economy. But this time it's the different ending where the new economy is winning and the old economy is losing. Whereas in March of 2000, it was the new economy that blew up. Maybe you could say March 2020, 20 years later, we're trying the alternate ending from the one that was tried in March of 2000. And so, yeah, I think it's broadly, you know, it's broadly the new economy type things that have had an incredible year across the board this year. And then the older economy businesses, I think are going to have quite a struggle in all sorts of ways. You know, I think it's going to be sort of quite complicated what happens, you know, the next few years. There probably are parts of the cyclical old economy that can, you know, come back partially. So, but I don't know, if you look at 2000, if you sort of say we're the opposite of what actually happened in the year 2000, 2000 tech went straight down and banks actually went straight up. So banks were sort of an old economy thing that did incredibly well in 2000. And they've had a very bad year this year. And because a lot of the banks are old economy businesses that should be competing in a new economy medium. Fintech is, you know, the internet is, you know, it's zeros and ones. It's money is sort of a natural virtual product. And so it's very natural for fintech companies to displace the banks. And there's a weird way where this year has been the opposite of 2000 on the tech versus banking axis, for example. And so I sort of keep thinking it's a lot of things that are just literally the exact opposite of 99-2000. We just have the opposite movie going on this time.
Are there certain asset classes that you would definitely avoid? It sounds like you could be maybe not short, but avoiding urban real estate and expensive zip codes.
Well, it's hard to say what's going to happen with assets. It seems to me we have this, you know, super weird experiment going on with, you know, with interest rates, where the interest rates keep going lower and lower. And is that going to be sustainable or not? You know, if they can keep the interest rates as low as they are, maybe a lot of asset prices can be stabilized. If it finally breaks, that's going to be probably a challenge, you know, across the board. But yeah, I know probably the one asset that I most strongly believe in, you know, as an investor, you often want to find things that are so stupid that other investors are embarrassed to invest in them. And so, for example, the FANG stocks were an instance of a stupid asset. It was the really big tech stocks. It was just Jim Cramer came up with the FANG acronym on Mad Money in 2014. If you just followed his advice, you would have made 8 times your money in the last 6 years. You would have done better than any venture capitalist. It was too stupid in a way. You know, and so if my candidate for the investment that is so big and so stupid that professional money managers are embarrassed to do it because it suggests they're not doing enough work is to just buy Bitcoin. We have a strange monetary experiment. Maybe you should be long gold, but gold is still the old economy asset, and probably it's Bitcoin more than gold, and nobody's in that one. So that would be my bullish advice, although maybe it's also bearish on a lot of stuff implicitly.
Let's talk about real estate for a second, Peter. Naveen just brought up real estate. Do you believe people are going to be migrating out of urban areas? Is that a multi-year trend? Do you think COVID's the only factor behind that?
It seems like it's a pretty big trend. And I think with all these questions, you know, the way you can flip the question around, you can ask, why hasn't this happened yet? You know, why have people put up with these incredibly expensive cities? And you know, one of the reasons migration in the U.S. was lower in recent decades than it was in most of the 20th century was that we shifted to two-income households. If you have a one-income household, you only need one person to move cities to move jobs, and you can move to a better city where you know, better living, better salary, whatever. When you have a two-income household, People have been really stuck in the places because it's very hard for two income people to coordinate their move. If one of the two is no longer, or both are no longer geographically bounded, all of a sudden you can unlock that. And there's a, you know, there's a tremendous, arbitrage, tremendous amount of rationalization you can do. And yeah, I think the big cities were just a bubble. It was everybody had to be there because everybody had to be there. And once everybody's not there, you don't have to be there anymore. You know, if you went to an elite university in the U.S., you probably thought that, you know, you have to move to a city, not just for work, but even socially. If you don't move to a top city, you will find, you know, a less desirable spouse and you might have dumb kids or something like that. That's probably what people actually believed. And I think all of this has sort of been partially unlocked this year.
Yeah. And now people want space.
And that, you know, there is a vast amount of space in this country. It still is a very big, rather underpopulated country. It's just it doesn't feel that way if you were living in Manhattan or San Francisco for the last number of years.
I wanted to ask about another migration, which has to do something a little different. You know, the so-called era of globalization was all about reducing costs by outsourcing certain processes overseas. Do you see some manufacturing coming back onshore or some other functions coming back onshore? It seems like a new era of domestic resiliency might be upon us, or maybe we just hope.
In theory, something like this should be happening in a very big way. It's strange to me that not more of it has happened. But I think, you know, I think in the energy area, we can always say that, you know, one version of globalization was that oil was the naturally globalized resource. You have an oil tanker in Saudi Arabia, and let's say it's $40 a barrel in Saudi Arabia. By the time it gets to Japan, it's maybe $44. It's maybe 10% more to send it halfway around the world. If you have a BTU of natural gas in the U.S., it's $3 in Texas. And by the time you get it to Europe, it's $7.50 or $9 because the LNG and transportation thing is much more expensive. So natural gas, it's maybe up 150 to 200% of a markup to send it up from the U.S. to Europe. Oil is a 10% markup. So oil is a naturally global market, whereas natural gas is perhaps a naturally regional market. And so if you say we're going, and then, you know, there's probably a way in which the oil economy was linked to petrodollars and money center banks. It was an incredibly important part of the globalization story. And so part of the post-globalization story is that we're moving towards a more regional world in which natural gas dominates. It's not the way people talk about it ideologically, because they often think of, you know, natural gas as the clean thing and, you know, clean is about climate change. Climate change is a form of globalization. But I think the actual mapping is that oil was one of the key commodities that sort of linked the world globally. And if it becomes less important, it will naturally deglobalize. The thing that's crazy about the U.S. is, yeah, we should just be doing manufacturing like crazy in Texas. We shouldn't be, you know, sending the natural gas to run manufacturing plants in Europe or in China or elsewhere. But I think the arbitrage is big enough in natural gas that this will eventually happen.
Yeah, it's interesting because the LNG terminals in that part of the country were originally to bring gas in, if you remember, 15 years ago, and then they were turned around to move it out, which is interesting.
Yes, but you probably want most of it just to be used domestically and then whatever you make with it to be exported.
Right. I want to switch topics a little bit here to AI in the interest of time, because that's something that's going to affect all of us over the long term. And it's really an overarching term, as we've discussed, that can mean anything from smart advertising algorithms all the way to, you know, some super intelligence that's going to destroy humanity. So it's pretty big scope. So I want to leave an open question for you, which is, what should business leaders and policymakers be worried about with AI? How should we frame the topic of AI with policymakers?
I think it's one of the areas where Washington, D.C. policymakers tend to be quite weak on all these technology things. And, you know, the sense I always get is that people often don't really, they just use these things as buzzwords, and everybody in the room uses them as buzzwords, and nobody even knows what they mean. And, you know, there was an Obama administration document, a friend of mine pointed me out the other day, where if you used every instance of the word AI and you replaced it with computer, it still made just as much sense. And so, you know, it's sort of like we should at least acknowledge that this is sort of roughly where the policymakers are, where they don't understand the difference between the word AI and computer. If you can do a search and replace in a document and it still means as much or as little as before. We somehow don't understand this.
Is this because they're not digital natives or because they're too far removed from where technology is being created? Or why do you think that is?
It's somehow there's a discourse about technology where everybody in the room knows that they don't know what they're talking about and they can just use the same buzzwords in a way that makes no sense. So I think if we were to make AI less abstract, is it the next generation of computing? Is it the last generation of computing? Is it, you know, superhuman intelligence? Is it just sort of big data, machine learning applied in certain kinds of narrow context? So I think you have to always sort of concretize it very, very specifically. I would say certainly one dimension of it that seems to me to be quite important to policymakers is, should we be thinking of this as a weapon, that it's going to be used in conjunction with cyber, in conjunction with other weapon systems, and that this is sort of what is really at stake in the AI race between the U.S. and China. And even framing it that way pushes you into very uncomfortable space for Silicon Valley. So I think we have to just, you know, avoid hiding behind the abstractions. Or it's like, you know, the Huawei 5G thing is again, it's a discussion about, you know, very particular things about 5G. How does it roll out? Do we need it? What are the actual alternatives? And hiding behind just the 5G buzzword just obfuscates way more than it illuminates.
What do you think about our relationship with China right now? It's obviously very complicated and it's fraught. But, you know, I think a lot of our listeners want to know what you think about it.
It's been quite hard to figure out a way to create a real win-win dynamic between the two societies. And certainly there are parts of our society that have benefited and that have done well. I think it's quite a bit less than it was 13, 14 years ago. So, you know, maybe there were some very unhealthy things about the China relationship in the mid-2000s, but there was a broad cross-section of U.S. business leaders that believed it would be good for their businesses, that China was a natural expansion market. And, you know, if you say what sectors of the U.S. economy still believe in China, I would say it is a subset of Wall Street. So it's sort of asset gatherers on Wall Street because they get money from China. It is Hollywood and it is the universities. And that is a relatively narrow pro-China constituency. It's mostly a Democratic Party one, but it's probably too narrow even for the Democratic Party. And so I think even in the Biden administration, it's unclear whether those industry groupings will be enough to overcome, you know, the very real challenges from China in, you know, military arms race, and, you know, hollowing out manufacturing in the U.S., in, you know, IP theft. You know, so sort of all these other places where the relationship is very challenged. And I think it'll be quite hard to get it to a healthy place from here.
Do you think a Biden administration needs to really pick its battles with China? I mean, we're in competition with them to stay, obviously. And a lot of people in Washington who are centrists think that it's got to stay a competition as opposed to something worse than a competition.
You know, my sense is probably the technology part of it is an important part where we have to stay competitive. And that involves, you know, questions about semiconductors to 5G to AI. And that's, I worry that that's an area that DC is generally uncomfortable about discussing, and that people would prefer, you know, talking about having an open playing field for trade in soybeans or something like that. I'd like there to be more focus on these hard tech and IP questions, even though that's hard to do.
Is policy around AI a way to possibly combat China? Because I know China is using AI in a big way to surveil its entire population. What should the U.S. think about in terms of policy there? I mean, should we be using AI in the same way, or is that going to encroach on privacy and civil liberties, et cetera?
You know, I would say one way to frame the challenge of AI is that it's obviously a new technology. It can be a powerful weapon, but there also are ways in which it has sort of a totalitarian vibe. And, you know, the one-liner I have on this is, you know, if crypto is libertarian, if Bitcoin or crypto are libertarian, then AI is communist. And it's sort of like it's literally communist in the sense that, you know, if you sort of think of the classic libertarian arguments against communism, is you can't find the price, you can't set the prices on things, but if you have a supercomputer that gets information from everything, maybe it can actually set the prices. It can solve all these sort of classic libertarian problems in theory. and you have a government that's sort of, it's like the God of St. Augustine. It's completely outside you. It's completely inside you. It knows more about you than you know about yourself. And there's something about that picture of God or the state that is kind of scary and totalitarian and tyrannical. And that's why I think we're right to be hesitant with AI. I don't think China has a technological lead on AI. I think the innovation is still happening more in the West than in China, but it is willing to apply AI in ways that we haven't been and we probably should not be. So it's a complicated technology for the West because we shouldn't give up on it. But then it is one that many of the applications of which I think are quite problematic.
Reminds me of the Ayasaron comment you've made in the press before, the token reference about, you know, all seeing, all knowing.
That's not the future we want.
Well, what does the future look like for the average American when it comes to AI? Or if I could do a find and replace, I'll find and replace AI with automation or technology or algorithms or any technological advancement, because it seems like technology is obviously embedded in everyone's lives right now. And for a lot of the folks watching on this podcast, they'll probably be okay. But for the average blue collar American, how should they be thinking about what happens to their wage base or their job base over the next 5 or even 10 years?
You know, I think the macroeconomic question is always how much are the productivity gains? What are the productivity numbers in the whole economy? And what's the potential growth in GDP for the economy? And I tend to think if we have, you know, accelerating technology, we should have high productivity growth, high GDP growth. And when you have those things, you can then solve all these distributional problems, and these other problems can get solved in one way or another. And the challenge in my mind is, the thing I worry about is not that we have accelerating unbalanced technology, but that it's actually not enough. And that we have this powerful revolution in the world of bits, IT, computers, internet, AI, but it doesn't actually translate to that greater a productivity in average. You know, we had this manifesto on our website at Founders Fund from almost a decade ago where, you know, they promised us flying cars and all we got was 140 characters. And it's not an indictment of Twitter as a company. It's a great company. It's great for the, you know, several thousand people who work there and smoke too much pot all day long. It's a great business, but it's perhaps not enough to actually take our civilization to the next level. And that's always the disconnect on the IT side, where some fantastic businesses have been built, but it hasn't yet shown up in the productivity numbers for the economy as a whole. And that's why, you know, I think the problem is one of stagnation more than even inequality. Although there's, you know, always one thing where it's tech decoupling from the rest of society. I think the felt sense people have is stagnation, that, you know, the younger generation finds it hard to do as well as their parents. And that stagnation seems to me to be the real thing.
You know, one of the things we wanted to talk about before we get out of the podcast is, you know, how are you thinking about education these days?
It's in a very difficult place because it's, you know, is it an investment? Is it a consumption decision? Is college a four-year party? Is it an insurance policy? Is it a tournament? And it's sort of some weird amalgamation of all of these things that does none of them terribly well. You know, I think high school education still works because it has a teleology to it and it's directed towards getting into a good college. Once you get into a good college, you are completely disoriented because it's clear it doesn't lead anywhere. You know, the only two college majors at top colleges that are translatable economically are computer science and petroleum engineering, you know, and everything else is sort of, you're just spinning your wheels. If you go to graduate school, that's clearly a step down from college. People in PhD programs are lower status than undergraduates. The undergraduates are at least the paying customers. The graduate students are sort of the indentured servants. And so there's something, you know, very, very odd about a system where if you succeed in it and you're supposed to go to graduate school, congratulations, you get demoted. I think the whole system makes extremely little sense at this point. And it's been sustained, like so many of the other 20th century institutions are, society, by the overarching idea, we don't know what else to do. There is no alternative. And it's kind of true, but that doesn't obfuscate the way in which it's beyond bankrupt at this point.
Well, what should a high school senior do if they're coming out of high school? Like, where should they spend their time? What should they educate themselves with? What industry should they go into? What advice would you give for someone like that who's, you know, 18, 19 years old?
Well, you know, certainly software has been the right thing to do for a long time. And that's, so directionally, that's probably still, you know, the best specific thing to do. You know, if you're going to go to college, you should probably figure out, you know, as cheap an alternative as possible. You should try to go to a cheap state school, you know, minimize the amount of debt. Maybe it's a credential you need, but, you know, just avoid amassing a lifetime of debt that you can't discharge even if you go bankrupt.
Yeah, I think President Obama was still paying off some of his school debt when he was running for office or some crazy stat like that, like way far later into his life than you'd ever would have thought.
Well, so many people are.
Buttigieg was. It's a little bit more of a recent. I think Obama, it wasn't quite that bad in the 80s. It's sort of
right.
Because the costs have escalated a lot. So, this is always where the older baby yes. boomer people, I think, just don't get it because, you know, in the 60s or 70s, you could work your way through college. And that was perfectly reasonable because, you know, the costs were manageable. And now it's just has spiraled completely out of control. And maybe with some pricing discovery thing where they realized they could charge more and more and they could get away with it. But it's now just purely dysfunctional.
You don't worry about education haves and have nots.
It's again, what does it mean? It's very hard to describe what the substance is that people have learned. And so is it just a status thing? It's just a credentialing thing? And it's felt like that's mattered a lot. I would bet on that mattering a lot less in the years ahead. You know, certainly the delta between high school and college kept growing through about 2000. It has actually not grown in the last 20 years because even though, you know, high school incomes have been stagnant, college incomes haven't gone up much in the last 20 years. And the debt has gone up more. So actually, the delta between a high school degree and a college degree has narrowed slightly in the last 20 years. So this was a real thing in the 80s and 90s, but it's actually narrowed some in the last 20.
Well, if you're a high school senior, we know you should go into software or a cheaper college. But what if you're, you know, a 30 or 40 something American and you know this is all happening, right? Technology is taking over the world, et cetera, et cetera. What would you do to make sure that your next 25, 30 years of working life are productive?
Well, it's always hard to give, yes, hard to give sort of very generic advice like
Understood.
This. I think there is, you know, I think the silver lining of this crazy year that we've just been through is there's a reset and there's a possibility to reset your life and reset it in a different city, different career, to try to do something very, very different. And we had all these stories that you couldn't reset. You had to keep doing what you were doing. And I think that's been exploded this year.
But definitely don't reset and go back to college. We know that.
I would not recommend that.
All right. I'm gonna stick with my master's degree and forget about the PhD. Peter, last question. What gives you hope or conviction for a better future?
Well, it's something like the indomitability of the human spirit. It's that there's always space for creativity, originality. People are going to always try to do new things. You know, I'm not insanely optimistic. But I do believe there's always a great deal of room for human agency, and it can be good or bad. But it's up to us to make the future better. You know, it's not like the singularity is near, a la Kurzweil, where we just have to sit back, eat some popcorn, and watch the movie of the future unfold. We have to make it happen.
We do not want to see the horror and let it go by. I agree, Peter. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, check out our larger suite of CSIS podcasts. From Into Africa, The Asia Chessboard, China Power, AIDS 2020, The Trade Guys, Smart Women, Smart Power, and more. You can listen to them all on major streaming platforms like iTunes and Spotify. Visit csis.org/podcasts to see our full catalog.